Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, please go to pnwa.org. Let's see what's going on this week. Well, it's we've still got our January issue, actually runs to the middle of February, of Author up. So if you haven't gotten a chance to check out the interview I did with Amy Tan, that great live conversation, parts one and two are still up, as well as my conversations with Theo Pauli-Nester and Nicola Griffith. Those were all great interviews, I got to say. So they're all still up there on Author. As always, if you're looking for a little dose of inspiration, you can pick up a copy of Write Within Yourself, an author's companion, available, well, any old place you would buy a book. You know, speaking of that book, of Write Within Yourself, I always envisioned it, even while I was writing those little essays and stories before I collected some of them. I imagine Write Within Yourself as a poetry collection, even though there isn't a single poem in there, because to me, that's what they felt like when I was writing them. They were short, they were sort of one idea, and they were an attempt to look at life from what I considered a valuable perspective. But because they were short, I often had to seek an artistic solution to the question of how I was going to communicate what I wanted to communicate. And I often felt like I went to the place within me where I used to go when I wrote poetry, when I wrote those essays and stories. And really, poetry for me, and I've been interviewing a lot of memoirists lately, perhaps because I've been writing one myself, was sort of my introduction into what I think of as creative nonfiction, because that's how I've always seen poetry. It's a creative attempt to look at life through a valuable perspective. And that's why I love talking to poets, particularly like my guest today, Miss Susan Rich, who's a Seattle poet, author of three collections of poems, The Cartographer's Tongue, Cures Include Travel, and most recently, The Alchemist's Kitchen. She's also a teacher. She's an editor and a bit of a world traveler and humanitarian, all around a pretty interesting person, just the sort of person I would like on my show. And she is. Matter of fact, Susan, welcome to Author.
Thank you, Bill. I'm happy to be here.
So, Susan, when did you get bit by the writing bug? When did you say to yourself, "I think I'm going to be doing that for the rest of my life"? Can you remember?
I think writing and reading came to me in the same time. I'm the youngest of three children, and so my older sisters were reading books and writing and seemed to have a wonderful time while I was kept out of that until, about first grade or so. And as soon as I learned to read, I wanted to write. I actually started out thinking that I would write novels. I think there's still one that I wrote at about age seven. But writing has been with me since school, absolutely all through that, and that was what I majored in and focused on. I never thought that I'd be able to really do it as a life pursuit. But then at some point, and maybe this is what you're asking, perhaps in my 20s, I realized that whether anybody paid any attention or not, it was going to be something I did.
Okay. And so describe that moment to me. If you ever did write a novel about a 20-something-year-old burgeoning poet named Susan Rich, what would that moment be like? What threw the light switch for you? Can you remember?
Sure. I think it's a long light switch, though. I'll start with it going
okay.
Dark.
I'll
start with the darkness, which was my college education with majoring in creative writing and having two professors who both went out of their way to tell me that I didn't write well. I really hadn't asked their opinion.
All right. I'm sorry. Please continue. I'll tell you why I said that, but go on. Continue.
And so, you know, they were my professors at the university. They were older, et cetera. And so I took them at their word and thought, well, you know, I'm reading Elizabeth Bishop and Adrienne Rich and Denise Levertova, and I knew that I wasn't as good as those writers. So I thought, well, maybe I better go off and do something else. And I went into Peace Corps, and I lived in Africa and traveled, finished graduate school in international education and came back to Boston, where I'm from, and was working for Amnesty International. And realizing that now I had gotten the kind of career move out of the way for the time being, I could really focus on creativity, and that I missed being creative. So I took a watercolor class, and I was the worst watercolorist in the class by far. There's no sense of false humility here. But I loved it. I would come home at night and paint some more molding grapefruits and dead fish. That was what our teacher gave us, because there's lots of shades of light.
Okay.
And through that watercolor work, I realized the importance of creation, and was able, when a friend called and said, hey, I know of this poetry class, this woman's teaching it out of her house. You sit around her dining room table and share poems. That felt sort of the right speed for me. That
right.
If I had been told by academia that I was no good, I could go to someone's dining room table and just share poems because I wanted to do it. And I didn't think it would get further than that. So there's the light switch.
Wow. Wow. So you had to be eased back in. Well, I had a chance to read your poetry this morning, and there was some beautiful stuff in there. And it really was. And obviously, whatever you needed to learn, in fact, I made that sound, that howl, because I was told sort of the same thing in high school, though. A teacher said, you're very imaginative, Bill. Why don't you make up the stories and let someone else write them for you, you know?
Oh,
and,
ouch.
I'm right,
sorry.
It's awful, you know. But the thing was, and this is interesting, is that by the time I was a freshman in college, and I hope this doesn't come across as a comparison to your college experience, but I had really devoted myself. I thought, this is BS. I can be a good writer. I know how to write well, whatever that means. Some college professor held up an essay I'd written and said, this is the finest descriptive essay I've ever gotten, blah, blah, blah. Okay. That was nice. But all that happened was I learned. I applied myself. I thought about it. And to some degree, that teacher in high school was correct that my writing was not as strong as it could have been. But that was because I was still learning. And just like you were still – it's so frustrating. You were still learning.
Mm-hmm.
You were learning.
I think it helps my teaching, though, because I teach creative writing, and I don't ever judge somebody's work or think this person is no good, particularly if they have the passion for it. And then I can just say, these lines are the lines that I find exciting and more like this, and let them go back and work on it. I'll just tell you a quick story. I recently got an email from the British Museum, which was very exciting. I didn't think the British Museum would be contacting me, because the first poem I ever published was when I lived in Scotland, and it was a British feminist publication called Spare Rib, and they were just deciding that it's no longer in publication, but it was worth saving, and the British Museum had to contact everyone who had something published in there to get permission to put it online. So it was an occasion for me to go back, and yes, I still have the journal, and to pull it out and look at the poem Afternoon Swim, and Bill, I was horrified at how terrible it was.
Not so terrible, apparently.
And I thought, thank goodness they took this terrible poem, because it gave me the motivation that I could do this. And that was what I needed. I needed somebody to believe in me. And so for whatever reason, they took what was really, to me, you know, no kind of falseness about it. It needed work. It didn't matter, because it let me know that I could keep going.
Yeah. Yes. It was your first little nudge that your voice could be heard. It's a great story. You were asked to go to this, you got invited to this poetry class, this very informal poetry class, but why did you stay with poetry? I mean, there's a lot of different ways to communicate with people through the word. Why'd you settle on poetry exactly? Can you remember?
I think it's in my DNA. I really do. Once in a while,
fit.
I Yeah, I write essays. I've edited a book of essays. I've published essays in different journals. And there's something, I think of that as cross-training, that I need to do some other genre in order to kind of move and find new ways to come back to poetry. But I find poetry much more satisfying than the other ways of doing things. It feels like we can move through space and time. We're not bound by the rules per se. We can create our own patterns and our own ideas. And of course there's rules, and of course there's things I need to work on with craft, but I feel much freer to be inventive and to research different things. The sort of idea of fiction versus nonfiction doesn't abide in poetry in the same way.
No, it doesn't. It's really such a loose form in many ways. And also, I also think that it's where I first understood the power of the working with your reader's imagination, because poetry really is a discipline of economy, and saying, what can I do to stimulate them? What is the least I can do to stimulate the most in the reader? You know, to because you're trying, you don't want to say, you can't say every little thing. The job is to say the most with the least. At least that's always been my approach to it. And you really have the least in poetry, and yet you want to try and stimulate the absolute most within their imagination and their soul and their heart and their mind.
I tell my students to trust their reader, to trust that if they put out the right seeds, that the reader will be able to do exactly what you said. And this quarter, while I'm teaching, we start each class with a free write, and someone came up with the scent of a man that she was standing next to was toothpaste and Old Spice. And that's just, that was our class. I mean, that became code in our class for, you know, involving the senses, economy of detail, juxtaposition of different ideas, and that says so much more than if we had been told, you know, 20 things about his bootstraps.
Yeah. Yes, whenever I teach writing, it's true. You say you want to pick the two or three details that tell you everything about the person, if possible. And even better, maybe just one or two that somehow summon an entire person that the reader's imagination then can flare up and fill in for you.
Right, right.
Now, as I mentioned, I was quite enjoying your poetry this morning. When I was reading through, and so I don't often do this, but I'd like you to, if you're willing, to read a little something for us, if you've got something handy.
I do, and in fact, I have something that is brand new, so your readers, your listeners will be hearing it for the first time. My fourth book of poems, Cloud Pharmacy, has just appeared, and so
I'm sorry. I didn't mention that.
Don't
in my
be sorry.
Intro. Okay, it's just come
it's
out.
Cloud new, Pharmacy. And it's a little ahead of time. Cloud Pharmacy.
Got it.
So I thought I would read the title poem from this book.
Perfect. All right.
Cloud Pharmacy. How many apothecary draws could I fill with these deliberations? The pharmacist's paper cone parsing out a quarter cup of love's resistant drug. Spoons measuring new prescriptions for my uncertainty, heart sway, gesture. Give me cobalt bottles left over from Aunt Iska's cures, albastrons of ointments, resins to resolve the double helix of desire inside of me. Where is the votive, the vessel, the slide rule calculation of how much good love, alchemically speaking, is good enough? I want spindrift nights on swimmer's thighs. I want an Egyptian elevator inlaid in camphorwood and ivory, a West African drumbeat, an eggnog, a god. I want waves and summer all year long. I want you, and I want more.
Now, see, that is awesome, and I actually did read that poem. That was one of the ones I read this morning I so loved, and I'll tell you, one of the things I loved about it, Susan, and I think this is so important, was the end. You found a beautiful place to rest in that. And it's always
Thank
a tricky
you.
Thing, but I really liked, and in fact, I have to say that I liked that of all the poems I read of yours. So I don't know if you are particularly aware, either paying certain attention to endings or simply aware of what you are trying to do emotionally with the end to mm-hmm. get there. But for me, you often stick the landing. So talk about, if you would, how you start a poem and how you finish it and how you know when it's done, if you ever do.
All tough questions. So I'll start with the ending, which is very like me. I don't go in chronological order, clearly, or any kind of clear line. And I think when I started writing the poems in Cartographer's Tongue, I wanted an ending to kind of tie everything up with a big bow or a strong drum beat and kind of like a ta-da, as if you were a gymnast and you were kind of doing your final, I don't know what the word for it is. I should have never been a gymnast.
Your landing, actually, the landing.
Thank you. Well, so the landing is always kind of a dramatic flair, and it's very clear what's happening, and there's a beauty to it. But as I kept writing, I thought, I don't want it. Life isn't like that. Life doesn't have a neat bow at the end of the line that lets you know everything's come together. So I started looking for endings that were more open-ended, that would still leave some sort of satisfying sense that the poem had done what it needed to do, but that there was opening for the reader to enter with the reader's life, with the reader's questions and ideas. And I really believe in the idea that the poem is a contract between the writer and the reader, and it doesn't become finished. It doesn't live in the world until the reader or the listener is there with it. So I'm trying to be conscious about having an ending that allows for that, as if it kind of goes on, and yet people aren't saying, well, should I turn the page and what happens next? So it's a delicate balance, but that's the balance that I think I'm really working with. Yeah. And with Cloud Pharmacy, I think it's one of the poems that just really kind of started. Oftentimes, I read for a while before I start writing. I can't kind of, sit down after a day of driving home and grocery shopping and jump into poetry. I really need to have the sense of reading work that I find exciting and intriguing as a way to get inside. And I can't say particularly what I was reading when I started this poem, but I could see that I got interested in the idea of a pharmacy. And I definitely have the sense that many poets do of a nostalgia and a longing for something else. So I started thinking about pharmacies I had known. I'd lived in West Africa and France, where you literally would go into the pharmacy and they would give you a paper cone with whatever it was that you needed, aspirin or whatever, and then just fold it down. And so I looked up different words for treatments and ointments and albastrons and just tried to kind of get that sense of cures. I suppose in some ways I have the same obsessions that come back again and again. Cures include travel was very much sort of not only cure for travel but for heart sickness. And in fact, that's where that title came from. There was an old medical book on cures that included all sorts of different cures for love sickness. And one of them was literally to have your patient travel. So I'll just say a little bit with this poem. In Cloud Pharmacy, life had changed, and I found myself kind of in love and discovering love. I sort of gasp as I say these words, but you said a poet must be honest. So middle-age love, finding that, and how that's really a different character altogether of finding love in the age of, my students in their early 20s. So having to balance this good love with life as I had known it, which was just kind of open without me being, answering or connected to anyone.
Yeah.
That might be too much information.
Susan, no, this is interesting. Yes, I've always wondered about that because I've been married since I was, I've been with this woman since I was 25. And I'm 48. And so this has been my real adult life. And I've often wondered, I know what it is now to go through a love relationship into my midlife and how that changes and how we change and everything. But I do have friends who are dating and falling in love, and it's a very different experience because I only know it as a young man, the falling in love part. And did you fall in love as a young woman? Did you have that experience as a
Oh, absolutely, yes.
You
many
did.
Times.
Okay, all right. And so how does it compare? How does that experience compare? What's different about it?
Oh,
is it more grounded?
It is, yes, it is more grounded. I mean, I had the experience in my mid-20s of thinking, feeling, sensing a real love at first sight, an instinct that was just an overpowering emotion and a connection with someone. And as I've gotten older, I think, ooh, that's a rather dangerous thing because it's a projection of what you're seeing, unless you have great telepathy, which I'm not sure that I did. So there's the sense of the idea that as you're older, you can have a distinction between what the fantasy of what you see as a projection of someone new versus the grounding of a human being who is, in my case, about my same age and comes with a whole character and history. Yes, it's more you're a person and I want to see who you really are, and I'm not as interested in the romantic fantasy that I so wanted when I was younger.
I would think that by this time, especially for someone like yourself who has led a full creative life, so you know, most of us want to be in relationships, but it helps, I think, to have a life that's just your own expression, and not to be looking to that other person to really make this experience worthwhile. I would think it would help going into that relationship, not having the thing that we do when we're young of saying, ah, you complete me. Now everything is good because of you, as that, I would think that all those years and certainly having a connected work experience could help in that, could help let you treat them just as a person as opposed to the answer to the question of your life.
Right, and I think for writers and for artists, it was very important to me to be with someone who got that part of me, that when I go off and spend 2 weeks away and I'm thrilled to have that time to write and not wanting any interruption, they would understand that I wasn't leaving them. So my sweetheart is a musician and a furniture maker, and so understands the artistic process without needing them to be a fellow writer. That wasn't something I felt like I needed.
You didn't want another, because I'm married to a writer, so you didn't want another one of those around.
Well, you know, in my theoretical mind, without having sort of specifics, I thought it would be okay if they were a fiction writer or...
Right.
But I didn't want to be competing with another poet. It's true.
Yeah, it can be tricky. It can be tricky. There's no doubt about it. All right. Well, so here you are. You've got your fourth book out, and you say that you write your poems when you come home from work. Is this true?
So for years, that's what I did. I worked for Amnesty International, and I would get out of work and, you know, have dinner, do something as a transition, and then stay up really late working on poems. As I've gotten older, that becomes a little bit harder. I've heard this is kind of a movement towards trying to do stuff earlier in the day. But to be honest with you, I either work late at night, or most of the time it's on breaks from school, summers. It's very hard for me to find the clarity of mind and spirit while I'm teaching three classes every day to sort of have my own creative space. The one thing that helps me with that, however, is that I've been part of a writing group for the last 10 years at least. And once a month we meet at one of the members' homes and share our work. And because I have that as kind of basically a kick in the pants to get something off my computer and to a group of people, that's usually what I can do. I figure if I'm writing one new poem a month while I'm in the academic year, then I'm okay. And then summers and winter breaks, I'll go off somewhere and most of the work at least starts getting generated.
I see. And so you have a writer's group. And so do you find it, well, you must, you've been doing it for 10 years, but you must find it useful not just to get you to, as a little bit of motivation, but I assume that the experience of sharing the work, and do you guys do critique, that kind of thing? You must find that useful also.
I do. And for certain, there's ways that we've really helped each other's work. A lot of the people in the group have now published, so it's kind of a wonderful way to kind of see that we're group think in the best way. But sometimes, really, it's just about whether they find something in the piece interesting. And I see it with new eyes because I've brought it to the table for them to look at. not to say that they don't do wonderful critique, they do, but very often it's really about what I do to prepare for them to see it. And then while they're seeing things that I might never have noticed, I see the other weak spots that I have to work on. I like to bring them to the group when it's very, very raw, because that way I don't feel committed to one particular direction yet, and they can kind of help me see where the interest lies.
They help you see where the interest. Tell me, I would think that reading it aloud to them. Do you read it aloud?
We do. The way our group functions real quick is that I would read the poem, and then the person sitting to my left will read it out again. And so I'll get to hear it in my voice and then someone else's voice. And then we talk first about what we admire about the piece. We always find the sort of strong lines and the exciting points. And then we move to points that, do we need this there? I'm not sure what's going on here. And then finally to, you might want to think about adding another stanza, or I think the poem is really finished 5 lines above where you wrote. So that's kind of our ordering. Very simple and very useful.
I think it would be great to have to hear someone else reading it too, because they're going to bring their own stress to it, and it's going to sound, and you're going to get to hear it clear, more clearly, I think, in their words. At least I could imagine that being the case for my work. I think that would be very helpful.
No, it's wonderful to hear it in someone else's voice, because you just kind of see, well, there it is, it's alive, and what does it sound like if it doesn't have me kind of projecting it in a certain way?
Yeah, and they're going to interpret it, even if they'll probably try not to, but they'll still bring some kind of interpretation to it. And you'll see what's open, what is there, maybe not there. That's great. Well, we're almost out of time, Susan, but I would like to ask you one more question for sure before we have to go away. And what I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
Oh, it has taught me joy.
Joy.
That's an odd thing. I didn't think I was going to say that. I surprised
myself. You know, I've asked this
question
like 150 times. That is the first time someone has said joy. All right. So how did it do that? How did it teach you joy?
I think the act of writing is an optimistic act. And when you look at my poems and hear them, you may think, wow, she's writing oftentimes about death, or maybe it's depression. How can she say writing brings joy? But it's an act of communication. It's a belief that your spirit, your life, has a worth in the world that you want to share with others. It's a reaching out, not in an egocentric way, but in a sense that someone else might listen and might hear it. And so even if it's a poem about the death of my mother, it's a poem that is speaking to something and saying, I was here.
Yes. It is optimistic. All creation is, because it says, in a way, it always says, I don't know why this is worth it, but I'm absolutely certain that it is. It is worth it to share something valuable with the rest of on this. Well, Susan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. And tell us again. Okay, so I mentioned The Alchemist's Kitchen, but the most recent is actually, say it again,
Cloud,
tell us again.
Cloud Pharmacy. The newest book is called Cloud Pharmacy.
Cloud Pharmacy. Go pick up a copy, everybody. Susan, good luck with whatever you're doing, and maybe we'll have you back on the show again sometime.
I would love that. Thank you so much, Bill.
You're welcome. Thank you, Susan. All right. Joy. What? Why shouldn't it teach us joy? It absolutely should. Because if the beauty of writing is, if you don't enjoy it, if you don't love it, you're probably not doing the best work you could, and you're probably doing it wrong. You want to share what you love. You want to connect to what you love, because that's all we want when we live. So by all means, joy. If you're not enjoying it, I'm not sure it's worth doing. Okay, next week, same bat time, same bat channel, I'll have Kate Campbell, historical novelist, author of Hall of Secrets, on the show. Until then, enjoy yourself. Do what you love. Write what you love. Be in love.